The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Friday, September 19th, 2014 from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So I'm flying to Georgia. As you hear this, I might be in the air, but who knows? You might hear it a month from now, and I might be in the air. So I have some packing hacks, pack hacks for you. And these won't really help your life, I'm going to guess, but they will give you an insight into the febrile mind of me, your host. Pack hack number one. When you travel with magazines, now I know a lot of you have Kindles and stuff, but I travel with magazines. In fact, pretty much the only reason I travel is to read magazines. Someone will say, hey, would you like to fly to New Zealand? Not really, but I could get to all of 1998's New Yorkers, so yes. So when you travel with magazines, what you're going to want to do is tear out all the ads. The new edition of the New York Times Fashion Magazine, you know where the table of contents starts? Page 50! Page 50! And then you can go through the rest of it and you kind of do a little triage and say, well, there's an ad for a watch on one side. On the other side, it's some tips on what to buy, what kind of socks to buy. That could go. And then I do this with all my magazines, too. I did have this insight as to magazines. You know, magazines weigh a lot. They're really dense. But as you read them, you become smarter. So there's almost what I call a density transfer, right? The density of the magazine runs exactly counter to the density of the reader. You become less dense. And then, upon having read the entire magazine, you throw it away and your bag is less dense. Interesting that. And this leads me to my other pack hack. You know, you have some shirts, like t-shirts, not really that expensive shirts, like maybe some shorts too, that are pretty much down to their last wear. I don't know, maybe you don't. Maybe you're the kind of person who throws them out way before it gets to that point. Not me. So I have a shirt. I'm like, all right, this still is the structure of a shirt. I still see where the head and the arms go. But I know I probably shouldn't be wearing this too much. A small rip has emerged. It's definitely going to become a big rip. You know what I do? I don't throw those shirts out. I take them with me on plane trips. I wear the shirt there and I throw it out there before I come home. This way, I will guarantee that I'm flying home a little lighter than what I flew there with. Same with the magazines. There's no density transfer, but it is an interesting life hack slash insane thing for someone to do who really should be throwing out more shirts. On the show today, in the spiel, I will be defining this, the very sound, the very content of what you're listening to. I'm going to use some labels. I don't believe in labels, except when I believe in labels. And before that, I'm going to bring you a pretty lengthy session with a musician. He played for us. He told us his life story is this guy named Xavier. I just think that you're going to love him, and maybe you'll remember, oh yeah, I heard this guy on The Gist when he blows up. Who knows if he's going to blow up? I mean, there actually was a time when he was huge, and then he became less huge. But of course, he's still got a gig to do the soundtrack for Leprechaun Back to the Hood. We'll get to that. Just such good music, such a good guy. I really enjoyed spending some time with him. But first, on the eve of a very large environmental march in New York City, I'll talk to one of the top thinkers and one of the top activists on this issue. That's right now. Bill McKibben is an author. He's an environmentalist. In 1989, he wrote a book, The End of Nature. It was a huge sensation. It kind of made environmentalism mainstream. He's the founder of a site called 350.org. It's a planet-wide grassroots climate change movement. So on September 21st here in New York, there's going to be a huge climate change march. So Bill, here's my question. Let's say that we don't enact a policy that is your wildest dreams. Let's say we enact the best policy that we could get given the current political climate. Let's say we do a little cap and trade and some stuff that's good. How bad's the environment going to be after that?
Well, that is a very good way of putting the question because it gets at this question of what realism really is. We're used to thinking about realism in political terms, what we might be able to get in a negotiation. That's a good way to think about it. That's how human beings usually operate. You give me some, I give you some, we meet someplace in the middle, we go on. The trouble is the negotiation around climate in the end is not between different groups of human beings. It's between human beings and physics. And physics is a piss-poor negotiator. It just refuses to compromise, to meet in the middle, to budge. That's our problem. politicians have tried to do exactly what you've suggested for years now. Let's do a little thing here and a little thing there, and the stuff that won't be so painful and that no one might notice. And it's adding up to basically nothing at all. The amount of carbon in the atmosphere went up faster last year than it's gone up in a very long time. The temperature is rising. The Arctic is melting, the ocean is acidifying, and it's time for us to understand that the important thing, political realism, in the end, it's trumped by reality realism. That's where we are, and I wish I could tell you different, but it's very, very difficult to spin science.
Bill McKibben, author of Oil and Honey, environmentalist, spearheading and organizing this giant march that's going to be in New York about environmentalism. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and see you on Sunday.
And now the latest development in living longer, brought to you by Prudential Financial. The human body is a miraculous machine, but a machine for which it's been really hard to find replacement parts until now. Today, regenerative medicine researchers are making huge strides in techniques that can actually create new organs and tissues. What techniques? How about 3D printed cells or lab-made organ scaffolds? Human bladders have been grown in the lab and successfully implanted since the late 90s, but these researchers are now working on more complex organs like kidneys and tracheas. Last year, they were even able to grow a new nose under a patient's arm. And that opens the door to eventual replacement of bone, muscle, skin, and even full limbs. And it's not just older patients who'll benefit from the work. Veterans and many younger patients need this kind of treatment too. If you'd like to read more about this and other fascinating longevity research, visit slate.com/livelonger. The Living Longer Project is sponsored by Prudential. So listen to this song. This is how this story goes with me. My friend Dave says, you gotta listen to this. I'm like, this is amazing. Of course, you're hearing it. And he says, you won't believe the story of the guy who did it. I'm like, well, who's the guy? Well, his name is Xavier, and I can't pronounce his last name, but he was this huge thing 20 years ago, and then there was an accident, and then there was a reinvention. I'm like, this guy's amazing. Like, he seems to be the sort of guy, you hear his voice once, you need to hear more. It's like, well, you should interview him. I'm like, sure. He's like, my friend Malcolm knows him. I'm like, set it up. And now here he is. Xavier Defrepaulez. Let me spell his last name for you. Defrepaulez. Xavier Defrepaulez is a musician with a fascinating story who makes great, soulful, funky music. The new album is called Fantastic Negrito. Hello, Xavier.
Hello, so, Mike Pesca.
Hey, man. Tell me about when you first came to California as a young boy. You were born in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I was born in New England. Yeah. I was conceived in the West Village, from what I heard.
All right. And not far from where we are.
Yeah, not far from where we are. Actually, on Cornelia Street.
Uh-huh.
And my dad had a business there for years, decades.
Well, what did your dad do? Well,
my dad was a restaurateur,
uh-huh,
craftsman, hustler, high priest.
Is that literal? Because
pretty much.
He's from Somalia, right?
Yeah, I mean, from all over the place. I found out later, I have a brother that's older than my mother. That's been part of the journey, is discovering who my dad was. He was actually Afro-Caribbean, so he never spoke about the Caribbean side, but he was a kind of a Somalian Bahaman background, and ended up in New York. And my mom was a pretty hot thing, and he got his hands on her, and 14 kids later.
14.
14, man.
Wow.
This is all pre-Viagra, by the way.
So what kind of music did you grow up listening to?
Everything. We couldn't listen to any commercial music. It was very strict. So Louis Armstrong, the Boston Pops, Harry Belafonte, a bunch of African music, and blues.
And when you got to Oakland, what changed?
Oh, man. Negrophonic.
Uh-huh.
You know, I got around, you go from New England, we're talking about the Berkshires being mm-hmm. the only person of color pretty much, and then met my brothers and sisters in Oakland, then you just heard it all. It was the beginning of hip-hop, you know, it was funk music, it was the gutter.
And your father passed away by this point?
Oh, he'd gone. I went into foster care when I was 12 and never saw my dad again.
Before the interview started, you told me what year your dad was born. You blew my mind.
My dad was born in 1905. I'm old sperm. the record.
Yeah, and so you went into foster care?
Yes.
And then what happened? Did you wind up with a family, your family?
Well, no, I just ended up with a bunch of different families. And then one family kind of rescued me. I was kind of rescued like a dog.
Yeah.
After being in, you know, foster homes, it was terrible. And that time in Oakland was a war zone. And foster home was just a place where you experimented with drugs and sex and fought off sexual predators and shit. But then a great family got me when I was about 14.
What year was this about?
It was in the 80s.
Yeah. Crack epidemic.
Oh, crack. That's, I mean,
gangs.
Crack,
yeah.
Gangs,
yeah.
Crack, you name it. I mean, you're in Oakland, you were in the mix.
So basically, you didn't start playing until you were almost an adult. 17.
I was an adult
when
I really started playing.
So you were out of the foster care system by then.
Out of the foster care system.
And was it a hobby? Did you think you could? When did you start thinking, maybe I can make a living on this?
I mean, I did some talent show, and I liked the attention. I'm the eighth of the 14 kids, so I'm totally self-absorbed and never got enough attention. So I liked the attention. I'm like, man, people like me up here, you know. And so I thought I better learn an instrument. I mean, back then, you better know how to play an instrument. So I just started teaching myself.
Well, you're a multi-instrumentalist, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah. So what do you play? Like, on this album, which instruments are you playing?
I'm playing some guitar, I'm playing some vocals, I'm playing some keys, I'm playing some drums. But, I mean, I just kind of hack away at them now because I lost my hand mm-hmm. when I was in a coma 3 weeks. And I call it the claw. You see this thing? It's called the claw.
Yeah.
So he can't really move, but he hacks away. I hack at the guitar.
It is your hand. It's not a prosthetic.
Well, I mean, no, it is my hand, but it's pretty much useless.
Yeah.
Can't hold the pick. I wouldn't say useless. That's a terrible word. It's just, it's different.
Like, for you to hold a pick,
I can't hold the pick.
You're not using your finger. Do you jam it in there?
No,
what do you strum the guitar
with?
What I do
is I take the claw. As I said, I would demonstrate the claw. And I hack away and I beat the instrument into submission.
Yeah.
Kind of, that's it's ugly, man, but it works. You know?
It's this great sound. And your voice. Now, were you always a decent singer?
I don't think I was always a decent singer. I don't know. It just crept up on me.
So the coma happened. You were in an automobile accident?
Yeah, it goes like this. Yeah. So I went from Oakland.
Yeah.
Learned to play a little bit. Went to L.A. By like 94, I had $1 million deal.
Literally Interscope Records, right?
Yeah, with Jimmy Iovine.
Iovine, guy who's billionaire from Apple.
Yeah, he's the guy who
produced Born to Run.
He plucked me off the streets and...
Were funky, like,
funky,
I'm reading this LA Times article from 1996, you're opening for De La Soul.
Yeah.
I'm sure those guys were like, you're amazing.
Yeah.
You know, let's put some of your samples on the next album or whatever.
Yeah, it was good. You know, Maceo, shout out to Maceo. These guys are great, and I think I was embraced by the artist community, but I don't know, I got that big deal, and I just got lost, man, and I wandered in the wilderness. I couldn't understand, like, the commodifying of the music. It was so weird to me, and I stayed on Interscope. They just kept me there. Well, like 99, 2000, I was literally driving down the street in Hollywood. I'd pretty much walked away from the deal, and I woke up 3 weeks later with a beard, not knowing who I was.
Really? You wrecked a car?
Yeah, some drunk driver hit me. And after I recovered, about a year of recovery, I got into the Afro-punk scene because I just couldn't really play anymore, and I was terribly insecure about singing, so I just thought I'd scream and destroy my voice. It was so... terrible. But it was okay. Some of that stuff was great, actually. And I ended up in New York quite a bit. James Spooner and Matthew Morgan, which I hear Afro-punk is huge now, but I was playing in basements, and it was great, though. It was a fantastic experience. You know, I messed around with that, did a bunch of licensing with my songs for films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my first license was Leprechauns in the Hood. And from then on,
horror film franchise, Leprechauns?
Leprechauns in the Hood.
What was the song?
It was on a record I did when I was Chocolate Butterfly.
Uh-huh.
And that was called Ode to King, Everything is All Right. Everything is all right.
Yes.
Okay, the deal, literally $1 million deal. So you had some money then. Did you blow your money?
No, actually, my brother's now a PhD. My other brother's a lawyer. I helped them.
We got 13 brothers and sisters.
Yeah, distributed it. I helped my mom, you know, get her first house and first car. Yeah. She still has the car. That's my mom.
Yeah. So you had this great deal, and then you made some money from licensing. So economically, I mean, your body was hurting.
My body was through. I mean, economically, yeah. I opened up illegal nightclubs in L.A.
Uh-huh.
Because the club scene sucked so much there, and I had like a 7,000 square foot warehouse, so I just put in like a movie theater, hot tub on the roof, a stage, and I just would open up at midnight, and the cops loved me. The cops would come there, smoke weed. They're like, the bands are great. There's women walking around naked. Sorry for objectifying women. No men walked around naked, just women. We were painting, body painting in bands till 6 a.m. And so I lived a charmed life, you know? And that was Blood Sugar X. I was doing this whole kind of punk-ish thing. And then I just quit at the height of it. I just got sick of it, and I was insecure and confused, and I quit for 5 years, and then I had a son.
Mm-hmm.
That changed everything. I didn't have any instruments but an old crappy guitar underneath the couch, and he was cranky and doing that whole thing, and I was like, how can I get him to be happy? And I kept making faces. He wasn't impressed. So I picked up the guitar, and I played an open G chord, and he exploded into a smile. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the power of that smile. It was like, hey, fuck you and your problems. I don't care about your problems. I don't care about what you're going through. I love what this vibration of this instrument. And then I slowly started going back into music. And then a year ago, I discovered Fantastic Negrito. So
who have you been, by the way, over the years?
I've been,
let's list them.
Dead From Sex.
Mm-hmm.
I've been Blood Sugar X.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was Blood Sugar, then Blood Sugar X. Me and this Japanese guy, Chocolate Butterfly, and now I'm Fantastic Negrito.
And in addition to the Leprechaun movie, which is, of course, a high mark, you do the theme song for this new Amazon show, Hand of God, right?
Yeah. I did the opening theme for a show called Hand of God, directed by Mark Forrester, written by Ben Watkins, starring like artists like actors like Andre Royo and Dana Delaney and who's the biggest guy? I want to call him Judge Purnell
Ron
Harris.
Perlman?
Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
Ron Perlman. But he's I call him Judge Purnell Harris on the show. And that I did the opening theme, An Honest Man. It's on Amazon. It's doing pretty well. I think it was a perfect song for the show. Very proud of that.
Now being, I don't know if it's too far, I don't know if you identify with the label, but maybe we could call you disabled, somewhat disabled. You have an
arm. I'm somewhat
arm,
disabled.
Somewhat
yeah.
disabled. How does that affect the music? I know the sound. Like, so you bang a little bit.
I think I bang a lot of it. It affects the sound because it's simple. It's kind of rudimentary. I really found the honesty in like what I call black roots music.
Mm-hmm.
It's the stuff that my grandmother and maybe my grandmother's brother. He had one arm. He was this crazy guy. You know, was listening to this stuff on the porch in Southern Virginia when I'd visit him and drinking Johnny Walker Red and grape juice, and he'd call me Amos, and that's what he was in his 90s, and he'd just be like, Amos boy, you know, this is when I check this out. And I mean, I related to the simplicity of that lifestyle, that music. It's amazing to be from that culture. It's amazing to come from descendants of slaves. I mean, it started to become amazing to me that we went through this journey in this country, and I thought, wow, it's beautiful in a way. I mean,
there's this parallel to your own experience. I mean, all these bad things and trying to escape sexual predators and foster care and a coma. And, you know, you add it all up and it's who you are now.
That's who I am now. Yeah,
and there's
part
like
of
more flavor because of it, probably. Even
probably,
it was freaking
I mean,
terrible at the time.
It doesn't kill you. Yeah. I mean, coming through this, I didn't think that I could.
Yeah.
Because I thought I can't play.
Yeah. You're holding your hand up now.
Yeah. I couldn't. I remember when they took this off, they're taking these staples out, and I'm sitting in there in the room, and I remember my heart dropped. I was looking at this thing. It's just massive hunk of...
Oh,
when you've
taken up your sleeve now, and I'm looking at the forearm, and there's huge chunk of flesh
Flesh
gone.
Missing, and I think, you know, my dad was in me, the good part of my dad, which was like, man, you're going to do it. If you're going to play with your forehead, man, you're going to do it.
That guy never gave up.
That guy never gave up, but he gave up a lot of his kids. That's a family joke. He did. A lot of us ended up in foster care, but that's the bad side. But the good side is he never gave up, man. Born in that the time he was born in, man, he had a business right in the West Village in the 50s. You know, a black man, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? He's a strong influence on me, good and bad.
The new CD album, Everywhere You Hear Music, is Fantastic Negrito. Xavier De Frevelez is, Fantastic Negrito, but he's a lot of other things, as I think you've heard.
But I'm Fantastic Negrito now.
Thanks, man.
Right.
Thanks
on.
For coming in.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
I got a feeling, baby. Oh, I got a New York feeling with Mike Pesca, baby. Oh, baby, 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 baby. Mama, no, I got a feeling.
Night has turned to day. Oh, night has turned to day. Night has turned to day, Lord Mama, the night has turned to day. Night has turned to day, oh, night has turned to day. Night has turned to day, Lord Mama, the night has turned to day.
I was walking in the darkness, I had not yet seen the light. I was sleeping with all the bad ones, and I thought I'd won the fight. At the peak of my delusion, I love money, holes, and cars. Now I'm walking in the sunlight, broken, battered, bruised, and scarred. Oh, baby, 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 babe. I walk how I like it, child.
And now the spiel. And I have an announcement to make. And it's this. You are listening to a radio program. Huh? What? Huh? But this isn't radio. You're listening to a podcast, or as your specific circumstances might have it, the noise from the inconsiderate guy in the cubicle next door, or the blather that's leaking from the earbuds of the dude pushed up against me on the subway. So let me say this. Sorry, ma'am. By the way, that's how we get most of our listeners. Also, actual GIST listeners, please bathe regularly. You are ambassadors for the brand. But what I want to say is that this is a radio show. Yes, it is a podcast, but I want to rethink some terms. The other day, I was listening to a pledge drive on KCRW, the Santa Monica-based radio station, an actual radio station where the radio goes out over the air. The station president, Jennifer Ferro, one of the fine people in radio, a very functional woman, which is kind of surprising given that she runs a public radio station. She was pitching during a pledge drive, and she said, well, we know you listen to the radio. And by radio, I don't mean the device of a radio. I mean all the content that this station produces. And that's when I realized a couple of things. I realized that it was insane that I was listening to a pledge drive that I didn't have to listen to from 3,000 miles away. But you know what? Morning was about to become eclectic, and I wanted to be there when it did. But I also realized that she was right, that radio is a thing in your home or in your car, but it's more accurately a description of the medium itself, not a device, but communicating, verbalizing, audio, talking. In the same way that a theater piece can be conducted in the park or in the parking lot. At Greenwood Cemetery here in Brooklyn, they did theater. It wasn't not theater because they didn't have ushers or they didn't have a proscenium or they didn't have strange goop under the chairs. Theater means the form, just like radio needs to mean the form. Think about radio's closest cousin yelling out the window. No, TV. Think about TV. There are new Amazon TV pilots reviewed in the TV section of the newspaper. And by newspaper, I mean website of the newspaper. And by Amazon TV, I mean the thing you watch on a tablet or a smartphone or any screen that's probably not actually a TV. I watch Breaking Bad on my computer. Does that not make a TV? I bought the MLB pass. I watch baseball games on my iPad. It's still TV. And this thing right here is still radio. 10 years ago, the term podcast was coined. Slate's going to do a big blowout soon about podcasts, the 10th anniversary of podcasts. And I want my contribution to be reclaiming the word radio. My guests are to appear on a radio show. I'm making radio. The thing you're listening to is a form of radio. Never mind the device. Radio, short for radio telephony, was once more widely referred to as wireless. And if you get your show via an iPhone, maybe using Wi-Fi, I've got news for you. Cell and Wi-Fi signals use the radio spectrum, just like TV does and just like radio, what we used to call radio before 8 minutes ago, what radio does. Radio is just a word that describes a form of communication, and I am here to say that this is that form. It doesn't have to mean just AM or FM. I'm sure the National Theater Owners Guild would like to restrict how we use that word too. I'm taking back radio. There are some in the podcast community who do not like the word podcast. Too limiting, too off-putting, and inaccurate. Apple doesn't even make iPods anymore, do they? It doesn't matter. If I'm not going to be strict and restrictive about radio, I also have to be consistent with podcast. Podcast has come to mean a form of radio that isn't first broadcast over the air, except like with Radiolab or This American Life or Fresh Air, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when it is. Podcasts are a way to get radio. There are specific differences between podcasts and radio, like resets. Do you know what resets are? And if you just joined us, Mike is going on and on about why he's actually now engaged in a fit of radio making. That was a reset. Also, podcasts don't have language restrictions. Podcasts don't have to be any set length. Podcasts don't have to give a station ID at the top of the hour. But radio doesn't have to do those things either. They've just come to be associated with radio. They're endemic to over-the-air radio as it's heard now. And here's where I want to take this. If this is radio, and it is, so what's that thing with the dial in the cars with all the static? That's over-the-air radio. Like we now refer to day baseball or acoustic guitars, we need to apply that retronym to over-the-air radio to distinguish it from this form of radio, which you get via devices, whenever you want, without static, rewindable, stop and startable, a little more niche, less traffic and weather on the eights, playing less Iggy Azalea, talking for 25 minutes without having to take a break that you can't get out of. Isn't radio great? And that's it for today's show. Andrea Salenzi, producer of The Gist, goes back to Wednesday's show and notes that the Finnish version of Top Cat was Topikati. In German, Superkat. In Hungarian, Terpi Yerfi, which means Mr. Menace in the series, and Fomaksa, main cat, in the special. Andy Bowers is executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and he tells me that in the credits 2 days ago, I said something truer than I've ever said before. All the many lies I've said about him in almost 100 shows. It turns out that Andy Bowers actually grew up across the street from Arnold Stang. Arnold Stang, the voice of Top Cat. You can listen in SoundCloud or go to iTunes. We're also on Yo. You get the app, you subscribe to something called podcast, and when the show is up, we'll yo you. Similar thing with our email. It's at slate.com/gist email. You sign up for our email. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/slate gist. Our Twitter feed is slate gist. Our email is thegist@slate.com. Now in Sinhala, which is the language of the Sinhalese people, Top Cat was known as Pisu Pusa, which is really cute, but you have to look at the symbols. I can't quite express the symbols, but the symbols, I swear to God, they look like cats. They look like five little kitty cats with a dash in between them. I'll try to read what I, an English-only reader, make of the Sinhalese. Kitty cat, kitty cat, kitty, kitty, kitty cat. That's it. That's basically it. That's Top Cat. Thanks for listening. I need a new beginning. Oh, I'm heading down the road. Another 45 years, drowning in a river of tears.